And we're here.
Welcome to another episode of Comedy Wham! Presents with me, your host, Valerie, and sometime co-host, Miss Purrington. ComedyWham.com is your place to go for features about all Austin comedy. We bring you articles and podcasts featuring the best in Austin comedy in all its shapes and formats. Launched in 2016, the podcast project brings you funny people and their stories. As a fan, I like to delve into a comic's background and motivations and will usually take a detour along the way. Consider the interview a way for you to get to know the folks that make the Austin comedy scene one of the best in the country. Today, I sit down with somebody who is long overdue for an interview, who I've interviewed his wife, then fiancé, and is one of the triple or quadruple threats of the Austin comedy scene because he can do improv, he can do sketch, he can do film. He does just about everything, and he does it so well. He actually has created and produced many shows, but one of them, I found this little cool quote from Laugh Button, that one of his shows is one of the 9 most unique comedy shows in the nation, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But he's also a stalwart of environmental.
I got some pets.
Stalwart of experimental comedy with the long-running and well-regarded The Sandbox, whose catchphrase I love. It's, I dare you.
Yes, yes. We often tell people at the end of the show, I dare you to do this show. And by the time the show's over, they're like, oh, I think I could do this. Yeah. Like, I didn't think I was eligible for this, but clearly they're letting anything happen up there.
And finally, hands down, the best Rodney Dangerfield impression that you will ever see in your life. And now, Comedy Wham! Presents Rob Gagnon.
Hello!
Hello!
It's so good to be. Oh, folks, it's good to be here. That was very, I think usually people just go, hey, Rob's here. That's very, very professional. Thank you.
I do my best.
And I've got a mug, just for listeners at home. I've got a mug of water. I've got chocolates.
Paint the scene for us, Rob. Mm. We've got a cat at our feet.
I used this pen last night.
Did you really?
Not this particular one, yeah. But I have a Comedy Wham pen, because you've had these for a bit, right?
I have.
Yeah,
yes.
And I was using one of these last night for Low and Inside at the
Mulvita.
Oh, my
gosh.
Room.
That's amazing.
That's very cool.
Do you know
cool.
that? So I've been doing this podcast for 3 years now. I have never seen one of our pens out in the wild.
Oh, man. Yeah, it was in my pen. You know, you got a little pen thing in the kitchen somewhere.
Yeah, because Ariel got one. So,
yeah. Oh, it must have been from Ariel.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, and it's solid. I feel like I'm not going to sit on it and snap it. And it's functional. Sometimes we have pens that are really nice, and then just very quickly they turn to garbage, and it's the nicer ones. They dry out so fast. Yeah. This is...
Well, in pen geekery, you know, there's obviously the intent of promoting Comedy Wham, but also comics use pens.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary to what they do, but also to that point, I didn't want to give out the cheap, flimsy little pens because I wanted to, you know, endure like Comedy Wham.
But they're not that felt tip stuff that you feel bad if you lose it.
Yeah.
It's like a nice middle ground
right,
of like, it's
right.
a quality pen, but it's not the end of the world.
Right.
It's not gold. That's very weird. The universe, world on a string.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Well, Rob, we are here today to find out everything we possibly can, which means this podcast will run 5 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
But we know you have one of your shows coming up this afternoon, and we will get to it in a moment. But I'd like to start these off with my icebreaker.
Oh, okay. Yes.
One word to describe your past.
I'll just be honest and go with the first word that came to my mind. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say slow.
Really?
Which is very weird, I think. But I think there's maybe a lot of hope in that. Like, one thing I know about myself and I've just recognized is that I take a while to marinate and figure stuff out. But once I do, like I think I can, you know, get a grasp on stuff. But so I'm somebody that, like, with comedy or anything really that I do consistently, I'm like, yeah, you'll if you like this, just keep doing it, and it'll start to come to you. But things don't always come to me right away. Mm-hmm. But then there are, I mean, sometimes that, I mean, everyone has things that just like they're natural at, but I feel like sometimes my interests aren't, I get in my own way sometimes. Mm. And then after a few years, you start going, okay, I think I know what I'm doing. Huh. So yeah, I guess I would say it's slow going sometimes, and it's a grind, whether it be like, self-growth, or, you know, finding the right person for you, or finding out what you want to do for, work, or, your passions, or your hobbies. Like, I think it takes me a while to get to these things. Hmm. And maybe it's lack of preparation or lack of knowing myself, but I think the most I like that about myself, because at 33 at this moment, I feel like, oh yeah, like it's 2019. You can figure stuff out and have success at any age, and yeah. You know, it's not so bottled up, especially being a guy. Like, I know my wife talks a lot about, like, just how often, especially in the past, women are just, like, put out to pasture, essentially, in the entertainment industry at a certain age. And I think that stuff's changing, so that's really good, and kind of plays to my lack of getting shit right the first time around. Yeah. So I would say slow, yeah. But it's a positive slow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I didn't realize about you, because to me, when I started getting really into following the comedy scene, you just seemed like somebody that had always been here.
Mm.
You just seemed like almost matriarchal. Like, you were just a presence here in the Austin scene, and I felt like you knew so many people and you were so well regarded that you had just always been here. But I didn't realize you were actually raised in the Northeast.
Yes, yeah. I started out well, I guess technically I started out in high school. I didn't want to do a real senior project and like put effort into stuff. And I knew I wanted to do stand up. And so like my mom told me when I was very early on in high school, she's like, what do you think about going to Eastern Connecticut State University, ECSU, which is just this little state school, part of a like four state schools in the area. And it was right down the road in a little teacher's college. And so I was like, yeah, that's fine. And I knew like if my grades weren't great, I'd still get in there. And so I kind of like didn't try super hard in high school, but also, you know, wouldn't get like D's and F's and stuff.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of my attitude. And I just carried that right into my senior project, which was stand-up comedy. And so I wrote like some BS for a term paper or whatever. But I think people liked it. The term paper, like, but I think I fooled them. And then I did my community outreach, was just putting on a show, which is self-indulgent, and I wanted to do that anyways.
So why were you so into stand-up that you were willing to do that as a project?
You're good. We're going backwards. You're good. So I think, just as a kid, I start bawling right now. As a kid, I think I had a lot of fun, being funny and silly, with my dad, especially, and watching, comedies, probably things I shouldn't see earlier than like just watching like Ferris Bueller's Day Off and in like kindergarten. He would pick me up, halfway through, the day. I would be at the preschool and then pick me up and bring me to half day kindergarten. And so we would have peanut butter and jelly and watch something for like a half hour. Uh-huh. And so I think we watched like where they dropped off the car to the shop and the guys are riding around the city, the mechanics. And so like, I don't think there was anything terrible in that scene or whatever, but it was kind of like, I doubt anybody did that just before they got to my kindergarten class. I think I was the only one that watched like Ferris Bueller's Day Off then or whatever. And every now and again, something would come on and my dad, he would put something on that he hadn't seen before and he thought would be fine. He'd be like, whoa, boy, hey, bud.
I do that.
You've seen people breastfeeding in public, haven't you? And I'd be like, yeah, I've never seen anyone breastfeeding. This is like 1990. I've never seen anyone breastfeeding in public. But like, I saw a little. I think it was who's that guy that's an ooze monster? He's like Swamp Thing, but he's ooze.
I won't get this. Ugh,
somebody's upset out there. I'm sorry. But I was watching that, and it was there was some boobs early on. My dad was like, sorry. And I was like, no, that's awesome. Thanks. But yeah, so I always had like some, I think that's how I got attention within my family, was like making little jokes. My dad is always very funny. Mm-hmm. My mom was always easy to laugh. And if she and my sister were bickering in her teens or whatever, mm-hmm. It was always good to throw in a little joke or a thing, or I think it's probably just a coping mechanism, and yeah. how you kind of find your niche or whatever, and that seemed mm-hmm. to be something that worked for me. And so then I would also watch a ton of TV. I loved to watch TV growing up, even though I was relatively active. But watching comedy. Just like Comedy Central with my older sister, Abby, who's 5 years older, watching Comedy Central and like the A-List and Kids in the Hall and old SNL reruns and Living Color and all this. And then on the weekends, I would watch Mad TV and SNL mm-hmm. with my dad and the Red Green Show, which was like a Canadian comedy that was really funny. And it had kind of like a Canadian Tim Allen guy on it, but like it was the best version of that. Yeah, it was really so just like getting, and I think being part of the comedy culture at a young age, and you know, just Simpsons and all these wonderful shows that you can kind of pluck and find. But then there was stuff I missed. Like, we've been watching King of the Hill recently, which is one of my favorite shows ever. Mm. But when I was a kid, I think, like, there was something depressing about it, maybe. Or, like, I couldn't relate to it because of the Southern aspect to it. And that was, like, a barrier for me, maybe. I don't know what it was. Or it wasn't The Simpsons. Or it didn't look quite as bright and beautiful, which is part of the reason it's so great. But like, yeah, there's certainly some stuff I miss and blind spots I had, but overall I think I was pretty lucky to be exposed to like good stuff.
Well, that's good to know. Yeah. That's what I'm doing with my son.
What are you throwing at him?
Well, we've gone to a few shows recently, so we're doing the live comedy experience.
Now, but we were at, he was on Laugh Darn It, wasn't he?
He was.
Yes.
He was. He's very shy.
Yes, but I remember him being super sweet.
He is super sweet and really quick to laugh.
Yeah, which is funny what to we me. Need. Yeah, that show is not always easy. We give away real prizes and they want them. And then the audience tries to not laugh too. Yeah. It's like, no, you laugh. But yes. And so what are you showing him? Sorry, live comedy, like so actual live comedy.
Live comedy. We will watch Netflix specials, and we watch... We've been binge watching a lot of TV shows too. I'm trying to think he finally got bored with Seinfeld when we got into like the fourth season. Mm-hmm. It was just, I think it's a little too much for him, but I'm willing to wager that down the road he's going to go back and realize like the gem that it is.
Well, maybe his peers even haven't caught on to that yet. Yeah. So when they discover, it'll be a rediscovery and he'll be like, oh, it's kind of cool that I knew that or whatever.
So I'm currently in the really, really sad, addictive state of Letterkenny right now.
I watched a few episodes and Ariel and I are like, we got to jump back in.
And it's kind of like you and Ferris Bueller's, which I watched with him too, and I thought, and he was maybe 10 when he did, I thought, oh, Ferris Bueller's, that is as cotton candy as you can get. And we're watching it, and I'm like, ooh, maybe just a smidge early. Yeah. He was 10, 80s. You know, so we kept watching it.
Yep.
And I thought Letterkenny was along the same lines, but it's really pretty PG.
Yeah.
But the language that they use is like really advanced. And I figure, he's probably not going to catch a lot of this stuff and it's okay.
I shouldn't say this maybe, but I used to, run a summer camp, and that was a lot of fun. It was probably some of my first performing was like getting up and running the morning hill time and activities and stuff. but there would be times when, jeez, I shouldn't have done this. there would be times.
This is recorded and will
this
be.
This is, I know, so, I know. No, you know. There's nothing illegal going on, but it's just like, come on, man. You're a good, you're like the assistant director. You're one of the top people. And but the counselors would laugh, so I did it. There, we would have all the kids like sitting on a big hill. And because we would have like camp-wide games at some point, we would have like half the kids go swimming, half the kids play a camp-wide game, and it's like a nice way to end the session, whatever term we were using. And so like when I would run instructions for the camp-wide games, the counselors would know to listen for me. And no, none of the kids ever caught on. I want to be clear at this. I was good at this. Because I don't know how good I'm going to do it now, but none of the kids ever caught on. But I would swear, I would yell a clear swear if you're listening for it. But the kids are never paying attention. So there's like 100 kids up on this hill, and I'm like down in the field going, all right, guys, listen up, shit. I want to make sure that everybody, and so just slipping in just a little, and the counselors are dying, and the kids have no idea. Yeah. And eventually they're kind of looking around like, what's going on? But just like, just the small, quick, not too bad swears, like ass or something like that or shit. And that was really great. How did we get to that?
I have no Jesus. Idea. Well, you turned the tables and you started asking me what I was showing my kid in the comedy world. And then we meandered.
You know what it was? Kids not picking up on stuff. Yeah, like, oh, right, I think a lot of times it's just like, that's not the point of this, which goes to show how frivolous vulgarity can be sometimes. Yeah. It's like, oh, they're following the story. Imagine that.
Okay, so let's get back on track somehow. Yes. Okay, so that show that you put together as part of that senior project, was that your first show that you ever did, or were you doing performance of some kind?
I would say, I guess it's tough to say. I would say it's my first official stand-up show. It was at Cafe Earth, which has now been demolished and built into a huge, crazy dorm with shops underneath it across from UConn. It was like, so my high school, E.O. Smith, was right next to the University of Connecticut. Go Huskies. UConn! And I didn't go there. I went to the dumber school. And so we had this place called Cafe Earth, which turned into a Starbucks, then everything got demolished. And when the UConn women have won many championships, the men have won a few, but the UConn women are dominant, for years. And so, they got money and now the UConn, the campus just kind of expanded, which is great for the community. Oh my God, Rob, focus.
Where were you going, Rob?
At Cafe Earth. And I was, and so I did the show there, and that was really great. And I think it was like a community outreach because I gave money to charity from that or something. But it was, you know, I think I drew. Oh boy, this is actually really gets back to who I am now. So I remember drawing. I already have relatively big nipples, but I drew my nipples extra, extra big and like sang a sexy song and took my shirt off at the end, which is so just the seed planted for what I do now, which is a much more sophisticated and I think artful, like hat. I love hat. It's my favorite thing I've ever done, maybe, but that also involves taking a lot of my clothes off. The Balance Brothers with John Buesman. All half naked things. In fact, the underwear. See, some of these things I've done, they're not okay. I want to be clear about that. I do think some of these things I've done are not okay. Like, I was in that, there's an underwear comedy show, and I think it's run by Joe Pettis out of Atlanta. And so there's this underwear comedy show, like, 5 years ago that I was involved in, and he was coming through town and he put on this underwear comedy show where people just do stand up in their underwear. And I think it's gotten very controversial now about this, that, or the other. And I just, I did the show and I don't think about it anymore. and so instead of getting skimpy and like wearing like a thong or like women's underwear or something, like I wore a full onesie, and then I just had my balls out. So, I know that's not okay now, but, like, in a small basement comedy theater 5 years ago, that's very funny to me. Like, everyone's just covering that up. And that's all. And not my penis. Just, no, you know what? It might have been one ball. That was always something I thought was very funny, is showing one ball. And I still think that's funny. But yeah, that was at Cafe Earth. I did that. I made my nipples bigger. And then I was off. And there you go. And I had it figured out, clearly. But yeah, that show went well, I think. But a lot of performing was, honestly, at that summer camp. It was every morning. Even when I was just a counselor, we would get everybody together, the whole camp, and we'd sing songs and play games. And we had, like, this challenge box where kids had talents they could challenge the counselors to, like, I can do a handstand for 10 seconds, and the counselors would always lose. And it was great. Yeah. I sound resentful about that, though. But no, the counselors would lose, and it was great. But I would host that every morning and come out, and I would do a little dance. I would come up to, I think by the end, I was coming up to, here come the hot step, word around. And I would dance up there, and everyone would go crazy, and we'd play games, and it was really fun. But that was very much like... anytime you work with kids, like, it was always just being silly and that kind of stuff. But this was clearly just me, a stage, being a hill, hosting, and kids coming through. And it's certainly like Laugh Darn It, like we were talking about, and kind of has a sandbox element of, like, yeah, do whatever you want to do. I'll host this and it'll be fine. Yeah. It will come out clean on the other end.
I'm jumping way ahead and we will go backwards again, but... You really are, like, the ultimate host.
Thank you. I've done so many bad.
Really?
Many times, because just to be clear. But yes.
It seems like people ought to be hiring you. Like, you know, those cheesy corporate gig type things?
I just got one of those, actually.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
I just hosted Christina Parrish's
her movie premiere,
Call Me Brother. It's Christina and David's and everybody's, but... and Andrew and I hosted that, and that was like one of those things where it's like I didn't do stand up, and I'm glad I didn't do stand up, but I pretty much did stand up kind of in a way. Like, I was cracking plenty of jokes, and I had some of them pre-thought and some of them I didn't. But it was, I felt like super proud of that, and I was very happy for that. When I do Laugh Darn It and that goes well, I'm very proud of that. And so hosting is definitely one of those things where it feels like I've got a knack for it, and I'm very happy about that. But I also, like, have just made so many mistakes with hosting that I feel super fraud-like to be like, yeah, I'm a good host, because I know, like, I've just, like, messed up people, like, especially early on, just messing up people's names or not caring enough. I remember one time I introduced, when I first got here, I think it was Kath Barbadoro, who's just so funny and so talented and so kind and good to me. And she was one of the first people I met here. And I was hosting Block Party, and I made a point to say how she was, like, a female comedian and she's really funny or something. But, like, I made a point of it, and it was just so stupid. And we talked about it after, and she's so gracious and sweet and was cool about it. But it was like, oh yeah, like, I've done that. I've been you get too many drinks in you before a show you don't really care about, because it's like I do this all the time, and then by the time you're done, you're like, man, I fucking sucked up there. It's awful. or any number of things I've done wrong. But I feel like I've got more, like, when I do bad now, I'm still doing good. I'm just not, like, everything's leveled up a little. But I've certainly screwed stuff up. And so if you're listening out there and you're screwing up, like, you're just getting better as long as you're honest with yourself. But you have to be honest with yourself. And that hurts. Cognitive dissonance is a word I learned a few years ago. It's just kind of, I just kept it open, the definition of it open on, like, my phone as one of the Internet Explorer tabs or whatever Apple runs on. And just kind of remembered, like, all right, there's the way you view yourself, there's the way you are, That was a big quote early for me. My mom said, perception is reality. And I didn't really pick that up for a long time. But now it's like, oh, yeah. Again, slow. But, like, eventually it was like, oh, yeah, perception is reality. And it really helps when you're thinking about, especially the modern world with all the hate and all this stuff. Like, it's not an excuse, but I think you have to start with that to, like, bridge gaps. I'm not an authority on that stuff. I just try to listen and and get better. But I'm not going to act like I have any of that stuff figured out. What are you doing, Rob? You're just going everywhere.
This is going to be the whiplash episode. I'm so okay with this.
And we can go as long as we need because you did all this preparation and it's so wonderful. You're being so nice. And I'm just going like, yeah, my mom said something once. Rob, you fool. How did we get
there? All right, let's go back. We're going to go backwards. Yes.
Okay, keep going.
We're going to do a little, what is it? Oh my God, the Wayne's World. You know?
Yes, yes.
Okay. What got you from Connecticut to Austin?
So I was doing open mics.
What led you to make that move?
Yeah, so I started off, I was doing stand-up as my senior project. I did one or two shows after that, but then college started and I didn't live on campus, so I didn't have like the traditional college experience, but I had a very serious girlfriend that I was so serious about. And I was very close to their family, and my little sister was like super young at the time, so I was so in love with her as like, you know, being her brother. I really felt close to her. And so I wasn't really focused on stand-up. There wasn't a lot of spots, especially being under 21, that, like, there's not, like, I think the comedy boom kept rolling, and now there's more stuff there. But it wasn't until a few girlfriends later, I would always go into these, like, 1 or 2 year relationships and then get hurt somehow, but I'm playing my part, I'm sure. They're very good women, and I'm also wrong, if not solely wrong. So let's clear that up. But there was a really bad breakup, and I moved into my friend Alex and his family's basement. It was a nice basement. His father's this carpenter. He does this really unique style, but wonderful Jewish family living in their basement, having meals with them, and like getting. I was already close with them, but like now they're like my fake parents for real, fake parents, and I love them so much. They're just here. They're great. But living with them, like trying different foods. I cook all the time now. I wasn't cooking then. They exposed me to like just a lot of good stuff as far as vegetables and things. I always had vegetables growing up, but once I was on my own, I think I turned down the dial on that. Yeah. And so opened back up with them, and I was like, ooh, salt and butter kind of make this go down. What do you burn this? And then it tastes better. That's unique. And so I started doing stand-up again, as depressed people are wont to do. Started doing stand-up again, and started going, like, driving, like, 45 minutes to an hour to this place called the Joker's Wild in New Haven, which has good parts and bad parts. This was in a fine part, I guess. Like, I don't know how far in any direction you would want to go before you could, like, be like, oh, I don't belong. This is not good. I don't belong here. But it's not, like, some terrible place. But I really, other than the Joker's Wild, I had no business being in that area or that part of the state. And I would just drive out there and do 3 or 4 terrible minutes and then drive back and get home at like 12 or 1 and then get up and be at my old high school to work in special education at like 7:25 in the morning. Ooh. And then I'd do it again. And wow. It wasn't like you could do that every night, though. With like Austin, you can go to 3 or 4 mics a night. I don't, but you can.
Yeah.
And with a varying quality, of course, but it's there if you want to take it. And then with, but in Connecticut at that time, especially, it was just not a big scene. And so there was like 1 or 2 mics, but the Joker's Wild was certainly like the bigger one. And eventually I entered a contest at the Funny Bone in Hartford, Manchester, Connecticut. And oh, the Joker's Wild. This is why I was talking about the safety of the area. It was, it had nefarious ties, we'll say. And oh. So there was some people in the back that rarely, but sometimes would heckle. And eventually somebody would tell you, if you didn't know, do not respond to those guys or give them a hard time or be tough to them or anything. And so that's a real fun time to try your new joke. Uh-huh. And so like as the area was not terrible or great, but the that particular back row is a little intimidating, to say the least. And it's actually, that spot is where I met Pat Sorois, who's a dear, wonderful, lovely friend to this day and a fantastic comic. He, I think he's from Killeen, but he and I met up there, and I moved down here after I won this contest at the Funny Bone. Uh-huh. Which was weird because I hadn't been doing it a long time, and it was a very unique situation. A lot of times when I hear people talk about stuff, I'll be like, oh, well, I can imagine how that went, and it sounds awesome. And it's like, no, I shouldn't have – this should not be. And maybe I should have won on that night, but no one was there. No one entered the competition. Like, it wasn't really anything, but – it was enough to make me go like, oh, I won this thing. And then I had to host for a weekend, and I was just awful. Mm. I was really – there's this comic, Joel Lindley, who was very sweet to me and like just had to like nicely pull me aside all weekend and go, hey, Todd Van Allen, this wonderful Canadian comic – he was also so sweet to me. I didn't realize like Australia had such a great comedy scene. And so he did this festival there. And I was like, hey, do you want me to mention anything when I bring you up? And so then I mentioned the Australian Comedy Festival. And then I insulted it like,
oh, no.
Like that it was nothing or anything just because of my own ignorance and feeling like a little baby not knowing what to do up there when I'm bringing somebody up. Just bring them up, you idiot. You don't need to like insult somebody or get a laugh. Just bring them up. Yeah. They're nice and warm and good to go. And so I just like learned so much that weekend and did such a terrible job. And they were so nice to me anyways. But that was kind of rough. It was in a mall, and I remember just walking around listening to these songs and going like, yeah, okay, we can do it this time. And I just did awful. And then the owner was like, hey, maybe take a vitamin before tomorrow's show. And I was like,
a vitamin?
I was like, okay. Wow. And then I went in the next day and did a little better. I got a check for like $100 maybe. And I took a picture of it and like coveted it and was like, oh, look at this. This is something. But if I'm honest, I just did such a terrible job. And Joel and Todd, I've wanted to reach out to Todd, especially, and maybe I will one day, but, just thank him for his graciousness. I figure the best way to do that is to just be nice and pass it along,
yeah.
Which I try to do. But, and so once I won that, I was like, oh, okay, maybe I should try to do something. I knew I wasn't ready for like New York or LA just because I was a little baby boy and didn't have a lot of experience. And so, my buddy Alex, who I was living with at the time, with he and his family, was also like, yeah, I want to get out of my parents' house. Time to like take the next step. And so he had been to Austin once. I had never been here. And he was like, I think they have a pretty good comedy scene. And I was like, okay. I think I really wanted to move to North Carolina for some dumb reason, which I ended up doing a show there once years later. And it was not did not go well. People started throwing trash on the stage. Yeah, it was not good. And so I'm glad I moved to Austin instead. Struggled mightily here.
When was that?
That was probably like 7 years ago. Okay. 2011 or 12? Probably 2011. So yeah, I guess it's longer.
Interesting. Because 2012, I would say, is when I started being like the hardcore comedy fan.
Wait, when did Obama get elected? 12?
12 and yeah.
Yeah, no. 12. 8 and 12, yeah. 16, never happened. So 8 and 12, yeah. So I think he had just gotten reelected, and then the summer after that, because I remember talking to students in the special education program about the election, and so I think it was probably like 2012, 2013. Oh boy, it's just going to become current day. I'm like, yeah, last week I moved here. I just keep upping the date. But yeah, it was rough goings. And you said, so you were just becoming like a fan. Yeah. You would not have seen me because you probably weren't going to like the worst spots to see the worst people at the end of shows. Yeah. But yeah, I it was around that time. And I remember the first night, I used to have this bit. And I think this is, I don't hate a lot of these things, but I do recognize that I was so stupid. And that's actually something I'm using to my advantage these days, is like when I try a new thing, I'm like, oh dude, you don't know what you're doing. You can do anything. This is such a blessing. It's once you figure out what you're supposed to do, you're screwed. Your brain's going to wreck this. So let's be new. Let's be newborns. And so I would do this bit back in Connecticut where I would get up there and I'd start real uncomfortable. And then I'd be like, I just want to, I used to love doing things where the audience hated stuff and I would be committed. And I think that helped me like to learn to be committed, but that's just kind of an evil way to use that in the past. Kind of like not in the best ways. But so there was a bit where I started to feel like I figured out doing like the weird thing. And I would get up and I'd act weird, or like I didn't know, I felt uncomfortable. And then I would go, guys, I'm really sorry. I did not mean to lie to you guys. My name's not Rob Gagnon. I'm not really a comedian. I'm a producer from LA and I'm just here to scout talent. And I figured I would like kind of get in with the comedy scene and see, you know, if I could find somebody and kind of save my butt out there. But there is just no talent here. Oh. And I don't know what to do. So I've got to go back there, and I've got a few shows, and they were all like Steve Harvey based shows, or I forget what they were. And so I went to, and that would go over well by the time I was leaving, because I had kind of figured it out and kind of figured myself out a little more. But I went here, and the first place I went to is the Cap City Open Mic. That's the place for people that are listening. That's the place where you go and you don't work on new stuff unless you're like very good and known. Mm-hmm. You just like it's semi audition-y. Yeah. And it took me forever to realize that. And so this first time I went there, I went up and I did that bit. And before I could get to like, there's no talent here, just like my shaky voice and all this. Uh-huh. And this, I think, was old ownership, because this would never happen nowadays. They played a sound effect from, this is back when the sound booth was in a different section in the front. And they played a sound effect and it was like, yeehaw, you ain't from around here, are you, boy? Or something like that, like over the speaker, over the microphone. Wow. And I just like kind of embarrassingly finished and got off and felt terrible, and eventually like wrote them a thing about like, I'm not gonna perform here or whatever. And like, that's so dumb. But I was like, that wasn't the people that are very good to me and I have no problems with. Which is true. Yeah, it was really bizarre, and I got off stage and I didn't know these people, but it was Maggie May and Roxy Castillo. They're both sitting in that spot, which is famously where comics sit in the front room at Cap, and just kind of hang out. And they're over there, and I kind of like go over to get a drink, and they're like looking at me, and they go like, "Hey, what was that? I was like, hey, I'm Robin. And Roxy, it was Roxy and Maggie, Roxy Castillo and Maggie May, who are wonderful to me, very talented, some of the most talented people in the city, and have gone to do fantastic stuff. And but they were young and early in their stuff. But even then, they were like, what the, what was, what are you doing? And I kind of, what a weird way to meet people who I went on to like respect and be friends with and whatever. But yeah, that was my kind of my introduction to the Austin comedy scene. And my buddy Justin Lamb, he was living in New Orleans at the time. And he was with one of my best friends, Zach. And so I had gone through that breakup. I was living with my buddy Alex, decided to fly down to New Orleans for a weekend. And I did like, I made a bunch of crazy videos. I forced myself onto a few shows. I tried to do stand up before this. That's a very early comic thing to do, is force your stand up and everything. But there was a band getting ready to play. And I've gone to New Orleans dozens of times now. Well, probably over a dozen for sure, for comedy. But at the time, it was my first time in New Orleans. I didn't really understand the scope of New Orleans. And so this band was setting up, or just finished, and then this next band was coming in to set up. And I was like, hey, can I do a few minutes while you guys are setting up? And then they're like, I guess, I don't care. And so I started to do it, and this guy in the back just goes, boo! Stop! Boo! And he's just not having it. And then there were two people afterwards. I still have pictures of them on my computer because I took a picture of them. I was like, thank you, Bruce. They're like, we liked it. That was great, man. Whatever. And it kind of like saved me. But then there was this other mic that I did, and I did really well. And so that felt good. And I did this video, Mime Stuff. It was a three-part series where, and some of it was good, some of it was bad and off base, but it was a thing where I would set up, I got dressed up as a mime, and I went to kind of like the French Quarter in New Orleans, and I put out a sign that says, Mime Stuff, 25 cents, and then I just went, Mime Stuff! Get your mime stuff here! What do you want? Me pulling a rope? Huh? I'm stuck in a box? How'd I get in here? I don't know. Mime Stuff! And it's online, and it's some of it's really good, but I remember like there's this picture of me like doing mime stuff with this homeless woman, which I would feel so different about and delicate about now. And I don't remember doing anything terrible, but like it's that thoughtless ignorance that lets you do wonderful things and terrible things and then gray things. That you don't know if they're, whether you did a good or a bad thing, and you're just like, I'm just not gonna watch that video again. Justin had messaged me and he was like, hey, there's this theater in New Orleans that my buddy CJ, who went on to produce for The Daily Show, and he's a segment producer for them, he's in all kinds of stuff, he's very talented. He's like, my buddy CJ, who I live with, does stuff with this theater, The New Movement, which at the time didn't have the nefarious reputation it does now. Right. But I won't get into all that right now. So I was like, okay, they have an Austin spot. Like, let me go check that out. And it was, I was at Block Party hosted by JPR. And this guy, Jonathan Hubble, was doing tech. He's a very talented artist, lives in Colorado now. And also a controversial dude. We won't get into that. I went to the Block Party, and a lot of people were doing stand-up, but you were supposed to be able to do anything. And so I was like, okay, I'll try a few things. And I did some weird stuff, and it went great. And I just got bear-hugged by the community. And that kind of was just like this huge jumping-off point of like, it's where I met my wife. It's the theater that eventually was turned into and changed ownership into Fallout Theater, which is fantastic. 7th and Lavaca, really well run, really takes care of its people and its students and interns. So check them out. But so that was like kind of this kicking off point where it was like, I found like a little home. And then I was able to work my way backwards into traditional stand-up where I do weird stuff even when I shouldn't, like in the finals of Funniest Person in Austin. But what are you going to do? I have no regrets. Truly, yeah. I think I'm on the self-love kick, and it's I think it's genuine. So let's keep running with it.
All right, you have just given me like I the know. Entire chronology of your life. Oh, it's Jesus. Time for me to ask some questions.
I'm so sorry. This is unbelievable. This is like 10 minutes at a time. And I keep pointing it out, and I keep not changing. I had yerba mate. I'm not drinking these days, and so I'm just having yerba mate and soda waters and weed. Man, that yerba mate tunes me up. Go for it.
Okay, so with a misconception that you had been in Austin forever and ever,
yes.
When I first started seeing you around, I also, from everything that you've shared, had a misconception that your background was actually first in improv.
A lot of people think that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm bizarre, I think, and a little bubbly, maybe. But yeah, I think because I do like a lot of weird impressions and a lot of experimental bits, even if it's like a show where nobody else is doing that. Mm-hmm. And then also because, I mean, I did graduate from an improv school and did improv for a minute, but honestly, there's so many factors that mm-hmm. you're not in control of, which I love about doing stand-up by myself and everything. But I'm the in that instance, like I'm the only one that's going to start to take control of it. Whereas in improv, it's such a delicate relationship. And I mean, if you want to do it really well at the highest level, which will, you know, potentially lead you to getting cast in things or being mm-hmm. seen in things, like improv itself is not going to be super profitable, but it leads you through, and it also just sharpens a skill. It's so valuable. Mm-hmm. But if you want to like do it consistently, that's what you want to give your time to. You have to accept that like you might be cast in a troupe. That's always weird to me, but I know it's very common, but like cast in a troupe with some people you're like, this fucking sucks. I don't like this dude, or I don't like this girl, or non-binary person, or whatever. Like, I don't like, this is not working.
Yeah.
And I know that can be like a valuable thing. Like, oh, work with people. There's plenty of that at work. Like, you don't need to do that with like your hobbies and your fun stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But that's also sharpening an aspect of your improv skills that is probably necessary if you want to have like your SNL audition or whatever, you know, like. So there's so much value that I got from that, but it was clear to me after a while that somebody's grandma being in the audience, let's not go blue tonight, or we're only three of us and we usually have seven of us, or there's seven of us to begin with. Like, that's fucking crazy. and like, so it's just too many factors that I can't control, and there's a lot of that in stand-up, but I feel like I don't have to check in with anybody. I can just screw it up myself. I don't have to blame anybody. It's like, nope, you screwed up. Like, I'm plenty okay being like, you're the problem here. Yeah. Let's work on you.
Okay. You have some incredible pantheon shows. Stone versus Drunk versus Sober.
Yes.
The Sandbox. Laugh, yes. Damn It. Laugh, Darn It. Am I missing any long-running shows?
Yeah, ATX Comedy Hour.
Okay.
The ones I'm definitely doing right now are Laugh, Darn It, ATX Comedy Hour, Stone vs. Drunk vs. Sober, and Sandbox. But in the past, like I've ran Block Party for years. I feel like I'm so disrespectful not to remember some of these things I've done, but whatever. Like the main ones, Laugh Damn It is Derek's and Laugh Darn It is technically Derek's, but as the host of Laugh Darn It, I feel
it becomes associated. With
I feel
you.
It's yeah. very much like my show. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly steering and driving the car, but Derek's putting all the gas into it and doing all the important stuff. And so like I consider that one of like quote unquote my shows. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of those they're all monthly shows except for Sandbox, and I think that is kind of an important distinction yeah. for anyone listening. Like in terms of spreading yourself thin, like. The quality could go up or down depending on where your focus is or how often you're doing a show. If you have like 3 weekly shows, you know, for me with Sandbox, like I've got it set up so that I'm not putting a ton of specific effort into what everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. I get my snack, my Rascal Pack. I try to make sure I have a relatively diverse group if I can. But honestly, people are coming to me with stuff. I rarely ask anybody to yeah. do Sandbox just because it's kind of like this thing where people are like, oh, I saw you did that weird thing. You should do Sandbox. And they're like, what's that? It's like, oh, it's Rob Gagner. Who's Rob Gagner? Oh, you've got to go over to Sandbox. And then they become somebody that's doing it like 4 times a year. It's really wonderful. But yeah. I do run those shows. I feel like you put a quarter in me and here I go. I do run those shows and they're a lot of fun.
Are there shows that you've done that didn't stick?
Excellent question. I when I came up with Stone vs. Drunk vs. Sober, I had 3 shows. One was Stone vs. Drunk vs. Sober, which went on to be the show that I've done for like 4 or 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And the others were Eulogized, which was a show where comics would come and eulogize something. And so it could be abstract. Like, I think I remember the example I was using, like Justin Bieber had just done some drunk beach driving in Miami or something. And people were mad at him. And I was like, so if you want to eulogize his career, you could do something like that. Or if you want to eulogize the idea of like, silly bands or whatever was fashionable at the time. I know that's a kid's thing. I was a preschool teacher then. You know, Cheerios, whatever's in. And so it was that show I did once and it went fine, but it wasn't a great experience for me. I think that's something else you have to learn is like, you can put on a show and it can be successful, but if you don't enjoy it and you're also not getting any like financial income off of it, like what are you doing? There's like, you know, wonderful things about putting on shows, especially getting comics on your show and you can get on their show. You're top of mind. Mm-hmm. I don't think comedy is as nefarious as people might think in some scenes as far as like, well, I never get on the show. Or like I only have this person on my show because I want to get on their show or something like that. I think a lot of it is just like, oh, I saw Taylor Doughty yesterday. Oh, I gotta have Taylor on this thing. Like it's less intentional in my mind. Like I think Robert Segovia was like, I asked him when he had done Stone vs. Drunk vs. Sober recently. He was like, oh, it's been a long time. And I was like, I thought I had you on twice last year. And it was like somebody else, some other good looking guy, Robert. And so like stuff like that'll happen. But I think you can, there's advantages to doing all kinds of shows, but once you can pare down the ones that aren't working, like that Eulogize show, the other one was Fucked Up Show and Tell. Show and Tell for Fucking Adults. I was big into taglines at that time and controversial titles. And so I think part of the reason Stone vs. Drunk vs. Sober ended up working out is it's not a homework assignment for your comics. And sometimes those can be great shows, but there's certain people that are like, Jared Holley is going to come on and do whatever he wants and it's going to be great and we're going to love it. And so like you could have him on Joy of Painting, which is a show where people do their act and they paint around and he's going to be great. But if you had him on like that show, Fan Fiction, it's Brian something runs it out of LA, but it's like a fan fiction show where you write fucked up fan fiction for something and then everyone presents it, but you have to like write a thing and try. And there's many comics that are really good at that, but you have to be aware of that when you're booking your show. Like, is this a homework assignment show? Are my comics going to do their homework? Yeah. And so like for Fucked Up Show and Tell, it was like, are they going to come with like a weird object or a picture of a weird object that has like this crazy story to it? Or are they just going to be like, this is my PlayStation and I like it? Like it was too much for us. Stone versus drunk versus sober. Like you're basically being like, all right, this guy's always stoned. This guy's never stoned. Let's have them do it. This person's famously a drinker in the comedy scene. This person never drink. Like you want every kind of combination you can have. And I think the title is a little provocative. So it got people that wouldn't necessarily go to a comedy show to be like, hey, cool. Yeah. This is, you know, and you attract a certain kind of crowd, but they've always been pretty good and pretty tame overall and don't get out of control. And of course we provide rides for the drunk comics. but for the most part, it's the comics that would ever get too far gone, but that doesn't happen too often. Yeah. We try to be very clear about like, hey, we don't need you to get smashed. Like, that's not going to be good for anything. Mm-hmm. Like, the audience will start to worry about you. They're not going to enjoy themselves. You're not going to enjoy yourselves. We're going to be taking care of you. Like, just get a good buzz going and do your set. You don't have to.
Is anybody thrown up on stage from being?
I don't think anyone's thrown up on stage, but people have thrown up immediately after. Oh, boy. People have been so drunk that they. This poor guy, he's a sweet man. I'm not going to name him, but I've mentioned this before clearly. And just started setting up the same joke over and over and over, and then would laugh when he was about to say the punchline, and then he would set up the joke and then start laughing again and not get to the punchline and then set up a joke. And he did this for like, honestly, like a minute and a half, 2 minutes. Oh, and then eventually we just had to be like, all right, okay. and so like we just like fed him water and stayed with him and got their, they all have, you know, their sober driver or whatever. Yeah. And so we got their person there and we were just like, hey, if we have to bring this person to the hospital, we have to do that. Like, we can't be stupid about this, but if we can avoid that, great. as many waters as you want. Not only, I try to pay everybody for that show, but it's like, yeah, you can have a free water. don't worry about it. Let's keep you alive. But yeah, that was the show that stuck. And I think part of it is the title. And the comics, that's one of those shows that's really nice to have somebody without a ton of experience on, because the crowd's usually pretty good and pretty warm and pretty nice and up for it. We don't do a ton of warm up top, Lisa and I.
Yeah.
And most people have success, like 6 out of 6 comics, or at least like 5.5 out of 6 comics are having a good set. And so you could have somebody with not a ton of experience, they'll be like, this was my best set I've ever had. Mm-hmm. And then you hand them $10 or Venmo them $10 or whatever. And they're like, oh my God, I've never gotten paid before. This is great. And so it's really nice to be that show for some comics. So I try not to shy away from, I know a lot of people are into like, oh, our show is just so good always, but I don't feel like judging people that harshly. And I also feel like, yeah, I just don't want to judge people that harshly or worry about it that much or think I know whether or not somebody's good. I mean, more comics than not, well, all comics were bad, but more comics than not, I saw be bad for months, if not years. And then eventually you'll be like, oh, shit, that person figured it out. They're awesome now.
Yeah.
Oh shit, that person's better than me. They are better than me. There's no question about that. And so like I try not to assume that like I know how good somebody is. Mm-hmm. I just go like, do I think they're good enough? Okay, I think they're good enough. I think there's a good chance they're gonna have a good set. Let's try it.
Yeah.
You know. So that's kind of my thinking with booking that one. But yeah, that's why that one stuck. And Sandbox is kind of the one I just don't worry about.
Yeah.
Like if it's.
When Sandbox started, I would imagine, but I don't know. You'll fact check me. Was it really the first show in town that billed itself as this experimental show?
I think Sandbox might. Because I really don't know, and there's so many shows. Mm-hmm. But as far as like one of relevance that's lasted for a long time, I think it's one of the only ones that was like, not only are we experimental, because Block Party was my introduction to that, like, that environment of like, do whatever you want, mm-hmm. screw up, fail, that's fine. And that's how I started ReSandbox. I go, we're going to see some failure, and we all clap. I go, how do you feel about that? Yeah. We all clap because, you really have to be open to that failure. I'll get to that in a second. Yeah. Block Party had mostly people doing stand up, and they would love when people did experimental stuff, and they encouraged that. Especially being like an improv centric comedy venue. And when I did Sandbox, it was like, okay, no stand up, just the weird bits. I know Waterbed does like weird bits, mm-hmm. But they have a lot of stand up as well. Right. So I think we're doing it the most recklessly, which I'm very happy about. Like, truly, people will just do awful there, yeah. and it's fine with me, because when you let people do whatever they want and you're like true, like you really can screw up and it's mm-hmm. okay. And not only can you screw up, we'll have you back and we won't be weird about it. Uh-huh. Like, it's and so when people are feel like they can do that, they try something like all the fun things that I like to do now, uh-huh. like hats or I don't know. What is you ain't seen nothing yet riding around in a visible motorcycle? I mean, that makes no sense. It still doesn't make any sense. It makes a lot less sense than Hat or any of my weird characters. But like, if there's a million dead characters, not a million, I don't write that much, but there's a few dozen dead characters that like I don't do anymore, or just didn't work after the first time. There's a lot of failure. There's manure behind these flowers. Yeah. Like, you have to, self-indulgent, but you have to, that's a metaphor I use a lot at the intro of Sandbox, is like, we're going to take a big shit on stage. We're going to plant a seed. You're going to water it with your laughs. And we're going to pick that flower, put it in uh-huh. our hair, wear it around for the week. Yeah. I don't know where I was going with any of that. We've reached our plateau. Yes.
I feel like I can get away with asking you this. Have you ever witnessed a fail that walked a room? Has anybody ever crossed that depth?
We've had messages. Hmm. We've had complaints to ownership. Hmm. And a lot of times this is a little tricky because it's like, well, I didn't do that bit. And I had a friend of mine approach me because there was somebody that was on the show and they did something that was of their culture, but was culturally insensitive to their own culture. Mm. And somebody was in the crowd of the same culture or religion or whatever it was. And they were like, they didn't know that. And I think even if they did know that, they were like, this is lowbrow and hackish or whatever. And so I just communicated with everybody because one of our regulars that was upset. And so I communicated with everybody and I communicated that I had communicated with everybody to everybody and just tried to be open and listen and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But even that person didn't walk. We've had situations where people, I guess, have walked out, but it always seems more like we're bored and mm-hmm. this isn't what we thought it was, and that's fine. Yeah. The only thing I don't like is when people talk and like, I just don't get that. I just don't get that. And I've gotten better at like breaking that up, but mm-hmm. it's really hard to not do that aggressively for me. And yeah. I think I have a sweet boy image, yeah. but I'm certainly a prick sometimes. And so like, just like, I remember this one show I did where somebody was talking early on and I was not the host, but I was just like, hey, shut up. And it got weird like all of a sudden, and it wasn't like some big slam. It wasn't like I was going to fight somebody. It was just like very flatly like, hey, can you guys shut up? Like what, or whatever like that. And it just made everything awful for the rest of the set. Yeah. And at the end I started doing this because I think it actually helps me to learn, but I was like, you know what? Shouldn't have told you to shut up earlier. You guys weren't being too bad. Like, I think there's a better way I could have done that. And I deserved this, but I'm going to learn from this and thank you guys very much. And then I do try to learn that. Like, I remember an early Sandbox where I really sucked and I just like, I was almost tearing up and I was just like, yeah, I'm going to do better, and I'm really sorry that this happened or that happened. And then I went back next week, and it's very rare that we have those kinds of shows. I'm probably jinxing myself for that this week, but yeah, I don't know. I saw
a video clip that Ariel Norman had put up of a recent off script, her show, very deliberately one where heckling is permitted. Yeah. And I saw your clip and I'm like, what a fantastic way to deal with a heckler.
I think.
Oh my God.
Because I think I just came in like so upset. Already, because even when I was driving over here, I was you interviewing me, and I'm answering all these questions, uh-huh. and then I just go, Rob, focus on your breathing, be in the moment, and then I would go, oh yeah, focus on your breathing, that's really good, that's gonna help you. It's like, these are just more thoughts, you dumb hippie. Listen as much Alan Watts as you want, you don't know it. Which means then you know it. Where?
I was bringing up the fact that the way you dealt with that heckler was just so great.
I was already fighting with them before I got on stage, so as soon as I got out there, I just started flipping out on them. And they would try to, like, interject a little bit with, like, yeah, what? And I go, shut up! No! You don't know! I have the microphone! I know what I'm doing! Like, it was almost Brody Stevens-esque, mm-hmm. if you know Brody Stevens, who passed recently, rest in peace. But he was kind of somebody that's very inspiring to me as far as, like, do what you want, do stuff for the crowd and the comics when you can. If it dips into just one side for a second, that's okay.
Yeah.
So I was proud of that, but I think was more embarrassed and ashamed of that just because it kind of, you let out like this weird animalistic side, which when I play basketball, I get very aggressive and asshole-y. But like besides that, I try to be a nice guy. Yeah. And I think because I try to do that or I'm aware of that when I even if it's genuine, when it goes in the other direction, I just feel so like mortified and ashamed and embarrassed. But it's gonna happen if you're putting yourself out there a lot. Someone's not gonna like it, and they might be right. Yeah, so that's the way that goes.
So from the on the drive in, then is there a question that I asked you that I haven't asked you yet that you wanted me to ask you?
No, I don't think I was paying attention to myself. I think one thing that was kind of important to me, I just kind of wanted to have like a disclaimer of like, I think I'm phony and I don't know anything. And so like, I also don't think that because I give that disclaimer that I can then say whatever I want, just know that like, I'm trying to be as honest and genuine as I can right now, but it's so hard to not start to just put yourself through these different prisms and filters. And
that's a universal theme, too. Is. Everybody feels like they're a phony and they're like, oh.
And we all kind of are, but I don't know. There's levels to that, I think. Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah.
Oh, life is so hard. You're so unlucky, Ron.
You are with your lovely bride going on a year?
It's over a year. Oh, yeah, we're finally taking our honeymoon.
Oh.
I won't say when. Don't rob my house. John Buseman's there. He'll defend it. He's going to house it for us. But we never took our honeymoon. We're finally taking that. But Ariel's just such a wonderful match for me, and I love her so much. Yeah. And she's also in a spot where it's like, I try not to talk to her. No, I try not to talk about her too much because I don't want to. She's so tough on herself that I don't want to say anything that she's going to like find a way to like Ariel bad. It's just, and like even last night, people were talking about how much they loved her to her face and to my face are saying this before the show and after the show. And I know that to be true, but like the way you think of yourself is just so so tricky. But I would not need Ariel to change But one of my favorite things about her, and one thing I like about myself, is that I do try to change. For a guy that doesn't write a lot of new jokes, well, I do write a lot of new jokes. They're just not jokes I can repeat because they're for like weird one-off shows or holidays or events or whatever. But like, I think that like introspection and growing and everything is something, and you know, we don't have kids and we're not planning on having kids anytime soon, so like we have this nice gap of like, yeah, we can be hippy dippy bozos and kind of like get into like this self-growth kind of a thing, and so I really appreciate that she just works on herself even though she doesn't have to, and I think that's kind of how we kind of coexist so well. Coexist, not the words, my fucking wife. no, like, I don't know. We're just super close and very in love. And we've got, like, this house full of animals. And it's, I'm just super, super thankful and lucky. And I recognize that I play a big role in it. But that doesn't, there's so many wonderful people that don't have what I have. And so I really do honestly, truly try to be grateful that, grateful for that as often as I can, which I just don't think I could ever do that enough. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of my, back to reality thing of just like, dude, you have a Nintendo Switch. You can just play video games while you and your wife half watch TV, and you can afford to order a pizza. And or you can cook, and she likes your cooking, and she likes that you cook, and you like that she changes the rabbit cage and the kitty litter. Like, we just have a lot of ways that we match, and there's a lot of like that. We have certainly got to the group mind point of like, we'll blurt things out at the same time in the car, like a random song. We'll change the words to a song that we've never sung together before in unison to a specific nickname of our cat or dog, cats or dogs, that or whatever dog is living with us. We got Lisa's dogs with us this weekend. And so it's like three dogs, a rabbit, two cats. We had a guinea pig not long ago. We had another cat not long ago. And so it's like, it's hard to take things too seriously over there. And you know, I life is really good. I'm very grateful. And I don't know what's going to happen with this world, but I'm trying to soak up all this stuff now. And that's why I was like, let's take our honeymoon. Because I had car payments and student loans into my 30s and everything. And everything's finally paid off. And I'm like, okay, let's do something now. Yeah. Like, nobody might be here in 20 years. So like, let's live it up.
Nice.
Which you could be reckless with, but I think I'm approaching it in a healthier way, hopefully.
Do you have anything on the horizon for you comedy wise that you haven't tackled or?
Yeah. So, one of my favorite things I've ever done is this short called The Dang Moon with, Dustin Svalock, who's, one of the absolute best, videographers, directors, editors, whatever you want to say. He's a literal pro. Mm-hmm. And, so he was like, hey, do you have any, like, this is just another way where I'm so lucky. And I know I kind of earned this, but I also, like, I'm just lucky. He was like, do you have any, like, single location video ideas? I want to test out this new camera. And so I'm getting, like, pro-level shooting and editing with Austin Studios, like, equipment he's testing out on the up and up. Like, he's supposed to test this. And so Ron and I, back when I was working just down the road from where we are right now, Ron and I were, Ron Leckler, who's a guy that was at Sandbox, and he was beaming at me from the crowd, and I went, this guy's got Sandbox written all over him. Now we're like thick as thieves, and I literally love him.
Great.
And so Ron and I just started typing back and forth. I was like, hey, I want to do a thing with you. And he was like, what did you have in mind? I was like, I don't really have any ideas. And so we just went back and forth on GChat, and eventually I was like, what about like two guys like looking at the moon, and they just love this moon. And like, we kept going back and forth on it, and slowly but surely, like, I kind of semi wrote that at work, and then we would get together and work on it, and put it together with Dustin, shot it in a few, like not even 2 hours, had a cut of it the next day, played it a few times, edited it down. And now it's like, just one of the things that I absolutely love. It's so silly and dumb and so like 1980s, like some of these slice of life SNL sketches. Uh-huh. Or I remember when I was a little boy, my dad went to rent some movie, I forget what it was called, and he accidentally picked a different VHS. Hello, kids. It was a different VHS, I think, behind the display case. Uh-huh. None of these words. This is the oldest sentence ever. So it was a display case. It's like an internet.
In a store.
Yeah. That's walls. Like bricks. What are bricks? It's like you ever play Pong? What? It ended up being, he was like, I don't know, it's like Waiting for Gonzo or something. And I was, he was like, you want to put it in? And it ended up being Waiting for Guffman by Christopher Guest. And we watched it, and for like the first, this is again, I'm slow, the first slow learner, slow brain, the first 5-10 minutes were like, this is ridiculous. Like, these people are for real. And then we went, oh, they're not for real. I think I recognize that guy. Oh, this is great. And it was just like, it's my favorite Christopher Guest movie, and just an incredible memory that I share with my dad. We bring it up all the time. Like, remember when we saw it? Oh, yeah, it was such a great night. And so, like, I feel like The Dang Moon has, like, a similar quality of, like, these two dolts just being genuine and sweet. Yeah. No one's really that mean. And so now Dustin and Ron, and we've looped in young Garrett Buss from San Marcos, are working on this really fun sketch. So I'm looking forward to that. But the big thing that's not necessarily comedy related, but I think there's going to be a lot of comedy elements to it, mm-hmm. is I'm working on this art installation. Hmm. Nobody has required this from me. There's no money involved from anyone other than me spending it at Jerry's Artorama. Shout out to Jerry's. And I don't paint or do any of the things that I'm doing. And so I'm kind of in that way. That's my advantage because I don't know what I'm doing. And mm-hmm. so I'm going to get up at Cap City and go, I'm from LA and I'm here to scout talent and there's none here. I'm going to do like a dumb bit. And so like basically I'm putting together this really cool art installation and there's going to be like an audio component because I know no one likes to read these days. So if you want to read about each piece, you can. But like if these, they're all, kind of connected to stories or things in my life. And so I'll write them out. And like, if it was one about my buddy, Zach, I would have the painting there and then you could pull up either a website or a YouTube page and click on that painting and hear Zach reading the story of that painting. Oh. And so a lot of my stuff is more about like process. Like I was whittling I went for a walk and got a stick that I knew I wanted to whittle. And I started whittling it with this, like everything I try to have meaning with it. So like I'm insane. So I got this stick. I got this stick and, we should talk about mental health. I go on Prozac now. It's great. I had a panic attack. It changed everything. So I got this stick. I went for a walk. I found a stick that called to me. I whittled it. And I'm going to take some of the paintings that I've done that I don't feel are bad or good. Just kind of, I imagined that I was, I'm sacrificing something to the art gods. And so I'm going to take that spear that I whittled and I'm going to throw it through these paintings. And then I'm kind of going to display that. And then, like, I found a marble in my driveway. And, like, immediately, because a lot of my anxiety, OCD type stuff that I have, and you know, my wife thinks some ADHD in there or ADD. I can't even say that. So like I would just like see this marble, this little clear marble in the parking lot, and instantly I thought like I've got to throw that through a painting, or I've got to cover that in paint and throw it through a canvas. And so I went out in my underwear and set it up on this chair outside my apartment and just started throwing this tiny marble through through a a canvas, and it almost went through one time. And after like 20 tries, my arm, because I'm winging this tiny pebble-sized marble as hard as I can, it's not going through. And so my arm is just aching, aching, because the blood's just rushing to my arm. And so I want to keep going because I want to get this done. But I also like am in incredible pain and I'm doing it to myself. And so I looked over and I'm like, yeah, it didn't go all the way through, but it like made a dent and like there's a hole in it kind of. So like, I guess I can be done. And I was like, nope, no, no, no. You have no talent. The only thing that you can have is process and commitment and passion. And so you're going to throw this fucking marble through this canvas. So I took the canvas, I got it off the chair, put it in a box on the ground, just stood over it, started railing this marble. And eventually it went through and I was like, yep, now I'm done. And so like, it's a lot of stuff like that.
It's like a metaphor for any comic.
Yeah.
And just keep doing.
Keep fucking
work
going
through the pain.
And so I'm taking these things I've learned in comedy and life and kind of applying them to an art form that I don't have any talent in. And, but I'm doing it with purpose and passion and commitment and intention. And I love it. I paint every day almost, and I do like weird stuff. I don't use any brushes ever. The only time I've ever used a brush was when I painted I took this wide rectangular canvas and I painted my Prozac pills I started taking. So like it was just basically two colors on either side of the rectangle, like, you know, a pill. And I was like, ah, shit, I got to do like the numbers on the pill, but I can't do that with my pinky. Like it's going to look awful. And like, then my OCD starts kicking in. And so then I was like, nope, here, this is the only painting that you will use a brush with because you don't want to take fluoxetine, generic Prozac. And it's like, you don't want to take that. Like, I'd love to be somebody that is like, hey, I'm always in this desert island scenario where I don't have my Prozac. It's like, you know what? Fucking blow your brains out with a coconut. You're not, you don't need to do this. You're weak. Get off that island and get to DMT world, baby. And so like, I was like, no, I'll take the Prozac. It's been just wonderful, but also like not a huge change, just the slightest little adjustment. You can tell I'm still fucking nuts. And so like, I was like, this is the only one you will use a brush with because it bugs you to use a brush. You don't want to do it, but you have to do it. And so like, if I've done 30 paintings in the past few months, this is the only one I've used a brush for, but there's a reason for it, you know?
Yeah.
There's another one I started running a lot because I've always worried about having a heart attack at 33, almost 34 now. And so I've had this irrational fear of dying of a heart attack at 33, but it's also somewhat rational just because I would eat and drink and all kinds of stuff. And I'm not like a great big fat person, as Buffalo Bill would say, Silence of the Lambs. But I wasn't in great shape, so I started running a lot and and I was also painting at the time. And so I painted like the asphalt and then I took colors that like represented my shoes after the asphalt dried. And then I took colors that represented my shoes and I put some wet paint on there. I drilled a hole into the canvas and tied it with some of that yellow nylon you can get real cheap at like Home Depot or whatever. Then melted that together, tied that to the back of my car and dragged that with the wet paint and the dried black asphalt background. And I dragged it around my jogging route and I got home and I was like, oh, that's done.
Wow.
And so like, that's just like stuff like that. And there'll be an audio component so you don't have to read, kids. but yeah, I'm looking for a place to put it up. I have this, it's going to be set up in a really unique way, but I won't reveal that yet. But that's like the thing I'm super passionate about right now. And so like comedy is just kind of a thing that I don't have to have as much pressure on, but I still have all my shows that I consistently do. So it's like, we're gonna keep doing comedy. Like, no, it's what I like to do. It's something I'm good at. I want to keep doing it. I'm gonna keep trying to get better, do bigger stuff. But like, I'm very, very into this this art installation thing I'm putting together right now, and there's funny aspects to it, but for the most part, like, outside of the stories, like, there's not some big visual gag, or it's not some trick or something like, oh, you get there, he spits on you and then you walk out. Yeah, like, no, it's genuine. It's I try to do it from my heart.
I am starting to get deathly afraid that I'm going to make you late. Let's for your check. Show. So if you want to do a time check, check, then we'll...
Yes. We should leave soon. Yes. I should leave soon. Yes. It's 3-something. Okay. We won't reveal that to the crowd.
Yeah. Okay. So you want me to edit this out?
No, I don't edit. I don't care. I'm always so worried about, like, giving away somebody's location or, like, my son was captured.
No. Let's see. All right, if I can keep you focused.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna try this because I have two questions. One is you can elaborate a little bit, but the other one, not so much.
This is great.
What relationship do you have to FPIA? Because you've been a finalist multiple times.
Yes.
And I have seen when you have just done, I'm going to have fun up there.
Yeah.
Sets.
Yeah.
Do you care what your relationship is to that contest?
I don't. I guess, first of all, FPIA, absolutely. I think it's such a boon for the Austin comedy scene, such like a keystone. So much can be gained from FPIA. I think I'm doing a disservice to myself to just do my more traditional material up there, present myself that way, have any kind of success through that, I'm going to be kind of living a lie and stunting my direction and all that. And, like, even, like, hosting at CAP, like, I've hosted there a couple of times, but honestly, I know some people swear when they host and they feel like they can talk about whatever, but I thought I wasn't allowed to do that or think I'm not allowed to do that. So I've always had to be, like, very clean hosting there, which is not my best stuff. And so, like, it's like, okay, this is not your avenue, but being in the finals is super relevant. Cap City can absolutely help connect you with showcases that are incredibly useful and just big opportunities. And so I want to make sure I'm always involved in those things. Yeah. And so, like, when I get asked to be on a Moon Tower showcase that there's going to be talent agents at or whatever, like, I'm like, yep, good. I don't need to feature or host for you all the time. I don't need to get a lot of money from you. You like me. I like you. You see where I can be used for, like, we want to have some character variety in this showcase. So we're going to have Rob come and do some of his weirder stuff. And maybe they'll like that and see how we're eclectic. But... so that's kind of been my focus with FPIA and Cap City in general, is like, I want to have as much success in all those endeavors as I can, but I have to use the tool that I am, you tool. I have to do it with, you know, I have to swing my sword. I can't pretend I've got some special thing that I'm not. Yeah. So that's kind of been my approach. And then I think there's also times where it's easy to kind of have an opportunity and go, like, I'm going to be self-defeating. And I think I've done that in the past too. But for the most part, I don't think I do that quite as much anymore. And I think it's a good thing to avoid. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's a perfect spot to be.
Yeah.
Be true to yourself. I mean, that's actually where I was hoping you'd steer get it a little. Be true to yourself. And
there's no success there. You might find success outside of that, but I don't know if you find happiness in that or satisfaction or comfort, or maybe that's not even what you should be pursuing. But for me, just having a base level great life going is kind of like, I love that, and to be a good person in the process and give other people opportunities and not leave too big of a negative footprint, like, I'm cool with that. If I don't get huge from here, that's fine. I think I'm gonna have a pretty cool thing going, so it's okay if it's not, like, world famous, if it's more so just like, oh, that was a great show and I got to do this really cool thing and I flew to this place and I got paid for this. And it's like, I'll just take 1,000 little victories. Yeah. I don't need the home run all the time. That's fine. I got a great life.
Well done. One more final question.
Yes.
One word to describe your future.
Oh, Jesus. This is a dumb word, but it's just it's just like slow was the first thing I thought of, so I have to say it. I have to be honest. I thought limitless. That's really something. But I did put limitless.
It's your
I word. Think we're all going to be dead in 10 years, well, keep in mind. But like, I mean, yeah, like I'm not even giving us 20. But like, okay. I'm so like, and I'm not 34 yet. Birthday's coming up, but we haven't even gotten through the year I was worried about. So like, to say limitless is kind of crazy. But I look at The Office and some of the actors on that show and how I didn't know about them until later in their life. I look at how great the present moment can be. And I think about how my life is now versus how I thought it might be and how very different it is right now, but how incredibly, like, I'm good with this. Yeah. This is great. Like, oof, you count your stars, boy. And so like, yeah, I'm okay with things being, limitless, mm-hmm. even if, it's not the traditional benchmarks that I always was hoping to hit or thought I would hit.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to find some pretty cool benchmarks that I didn't even know I cared about. So yeah, this was a lot of fun.
Okay. Well.
Yes.
That is a wrap on Comedy Wham presents Rob Gagnon.
Oh, one more thing, no!
Tell us where we can find you on social media, promote things, and then sneak in
one more thing,
but you are going to...
Okay. Seriously, it's 4 o'clock. I have to be at those kids. I'm very far away.
I know.
I'm going to start standing up now. Okay. You can find me on Twitter, @ Rob Gagnon. I only promote because I don't want your shit, so I don't even bother putting jokes on there. Come to a live show. You risk something. You risk something, you asshole. This is like an off script all over again. So find me @ Rob Gagnon's on Twitter and Instagram. I just promote stuff there. But more importantly, come to Sandbox. There are other shows that I do, which are also great. And Sandbox might not be the one that's like sold out or whatever, but goddamn, is it special. And I think you'll really find something cool. And if you want to see me be myself, that usually is like the spot to do it. Also, let me know if you have any connections to art galleries that I could put something up in. I don't care. All right.
Okay. We hope you've enjoyed hearing about how Rob got to be the comedic genius and master experimenter that you heard today just as much as I have. Visit ComedyWham.com. Rate, review us, iTunes, podcast player, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @ Comedy Wham. This has been Comedy Wham.
Comedy Wham!
Rob Gagnon. I'm Valerie, and that's been funny. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you so much. This was excellent.